Hey there. Welcome to Made in Japan, Conversations with Meljo Catalan. This is my podcast about Japan, but it's not just your run-of-the-mill cool Japan podcast. I want to explore a side of Japan besides the sushi and sumo, anime and video games. I'm here to extrapolate and meditate with the local people that your travel guide probably doesn't touch on. People that are hungry for making it and people that have made it. This podcast is my talks with them. Welcome back, Made in Japan listeners. It's good to be back in Tokyo. If you didn't see my posts on social media, I've been on a holiday in London, which was a blast, by the way. Much cooler weather and then much needed to cool down from the humidity of the Tokyo summer. So, it's good to be back, and I'm back with a very good and long episode. And if you're new to this podcast, I think this one is really a great one to start with. I'm talking to one Walter Edwards. He is one of the first people I've known that worked in the Japanese business corporate machine. And I think this episode is quite longer than my usual episodes, although there's a lot of things that Walter has experienced, and his story is quite important to what's it like to live and work in the Japanese corporate world. So yeah, I'm just gonna let it go and just let Walter do his thing. So without further ado, this is Walter Edwards. Here we go.
These days,
I've been watching. So that's one thing I wanted to talk to you about it today. Okay. I noticed that you were really into cooking now.
Right. Yeah.
And
very
I noticed
much
that
so.
Your posts are kind of like trying out new things. But you always say like, it's on the list.
Right.
And it's on the list.
And sometimes I get to it.
I don't get if it's an inside joke or something, or
I don't know. It's just like how I hear it in my head. I'm like, to the list. that's how I put it out there.
So every time you post something, I'm like, where's this list and where can I find it?
You know what it is? Like, I save it there just so I can put it out there. I mean, get people's comments. But like, it's more as a reminder myself. I go back to my own feed. I'm like, what was that thing again?
Yeah.
And on Instagram, there's an interesting feature where you can save a post. And so I go back to my saved posts. Mm-hmm. And there, it's pretty much a list of recipes.
Archive,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So what's the latest food that you're challenging to make now? Like, what cuisine specifically are you into?
Okay, so there's a couple. The way this all started, a couple of years ago, I moved to a new place. And before I moved, I said, okay, if I get a bigger kitchen, I want to spend a lot more time cooking.
Mm-hmm.
To make good use of that kitchen. So I did move, got a bigger kitchen, and I started out with what I called my own, like, just Asian fusion.
Okay.
So I like a lot of, like, Japanese food, Chinese food, Korean food, Thai food, and so I used to just come up with the things on my own.
Right.
I then started making, I focused a bit on Cantonese food, and that took me down a certain path.
Okay.
But then, So my background, my dad is from Antigua in the West Indies. My mother's from Guyana in South America. And so, you know, after growing up in the United States, I thought, like, you know, I wanted to maintain a connection to kind of the culture that I've come from.
Right.
And so I've actually started learning how to make food from Guyana and food from Antigua as well.
Right. Okay. That makes... Okay, because I actually wanted to start off with your roots, your background.
Right.
Actually, you know, we just started, but anyways.
I figured so. I didn't want to ask, like, did this start? Is this mic on? Hello?
I know. It's not really a food podcast, but
right.
Can you introduce yourself?
Okay, so my name is Walter Edwards.
Yeah.
I grew up in the United States with a dad, as I mentioned, from Antigua, a mother from Guyana in South America. I've been living in Japan for the past almost 16 years.
Yeah, you've been here for a while now.
Yeah.
But I want to go start back from
sure.
where you grew up. Did you grow up in New England?
No. So I went to university in New England, but I went to I grew up in Mount Vernon, New York. So it's Mount Vernon, north of the Bronx. Yeah. It's begin where Westchester County begins and the city ends.
You would know my cousins that live in the Bronx. They okay. went to private Catholic schools. I believe in Portchester.
Okay. Yeah. That's part of Westchester.
Like Our Lady something.
Right.
But it's around it's Rye, Portchester area.
Right.
Is that the same neighborhood?
It's not the same neighborhood. It's closer. You get in a car, I guess. What is that? A 20-minute car ride,
yeah,
maybe?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, they always have to take the bus, like from the Bronx. It's like a half-hour ride.
Yeah.
To school back and forth because my aunts didn't want them to like go to a school in the Bronx. They
right.
wanted them to go to a proper Catholic school.
Right. Right.
And like, I guess that was like one of the best ones okay. in that area. So that was my fond memory of when I go visit my cousins in New York.
Right.
I remember like. Going to Rye first, and like, why am I in this really nice, you know, suburban neighborhood of say New York? And then we go to the Bronx. So
right, right.
I remember that memory of mine. This was the early 90s for me.
I used to go to Rye every once in a while because they had an amusement park.
Yes,
Playland.
Playland, yeah.
Right. So, yeah, that was like the nearest amusement park pretty much growing up.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what was life like for you growing up? Like, you know, did you often go to the city, or were you always in that area?
So I didn't go. Well, okay. I had an aunt, my dad's aunt, so my great aunt. Is it great aunt or grand aunt? Anyway, my aunt lived in the Bronx, just off of Boston Road. A fairly well-known area in the Bronx, quite near it was the Bronx Zoo.
Bronx Zoo, okay.
As everybody knows. And a place that I don't think it exists anymore, but Skate Key. Skate Key was a roller skating rink, and I think everybody pretty much knew about Skate Key. And so I went there a couple of times as a kid. And then the church where I grew up is in Harlem.
Okay.
And so I was in Harlem every Sunday,
okay.
Pretty much. But outside of that, we didn't really go to the city very much.
Right. And as I mentioned before, you know,
yeah.
And I grew up in Connecticut, and then I would spend some time in the Bronx. I never went to Manhattan.
Okay.
To me, New York City was always the Bronx.
Okay.
And
interesting.
It was, and to me, like I sometimes would go to like Queens, to, like hang out with my cousin's friends, or like, but most of the time was Fordham University area and in that area of the Bronx.
Okay. South yeah, Bronx, yeah,
yeah.
I know that area.
And so. To me, that was New York City, and I would always feel like going to Manhattan was like kind of like going to like Disneyland.
Right, it's a special thing, right?
It's a very big thing for us.
So same here. you know, I have the aunt that lives in the Bronx. I have my grandmother, my mother's mother, lives in Queens. So, you know, sometimes I was visiting the Bronx, and sometimes I was visiting Queens, especially like my grandmother liked to have Thanksgiving and Christmas dinner sometimes. So, you know, went quite a bit to Queens. But yeah, Manhattan was, you know, on Sunday, but there was nobody else in Manhattan for me, family wise.
I think it's just a cool thing to think about. I don't know, it's just kind of a nostalgic thing about, you know, back in the day. But, anyways, so yeah, growing up, when did you start? Because I want to know, when did you start getting interested about Japan or Japanese culture?
Okay, so this goes back to when I was in kindergarten. So I went to a Montessori school, and for anyone who's not familiar with the Montessori system, it's kind of a lot less structured compared to most schools. Just give an example of what like a day is like. So you come in, you're like you're 4 years old, and you come into this place, and it's this kind of huge learning center where certain times, periods of the day, I'm running around, you know, playing games or reading or working with other kids on puzzles or something like that. But then there's set time to where we're listening to music like Tchaikovsky. And so to get into the point, there was they were teaching me Spanish. And so that's when I first learned Spanish as a second language and learned how to count from 1 to 10, learned a lot of vocabulary words that I never forgot. And then just when I thought things couldn't get any more interesting, all of a sudden I had a Japanese teacher teaching me 1 to 10 in Japanese.
What grade was this? What?
I was in kindergarten.
That's amazing.
So, I mean, but at that age, amazing it's exposure. Amazing how much kids can absorb.
Right.
And it's one of the best times to expose kids to different things. So, I mean, I love learning languages. Right. And Yeah, I've always loved music, but right. Tchaikovsky is some one of the composers' work I listen to.
I do know, like, from reading child psychology research, sure. like, that's the ages between 3 to 5, they consider that like kind of like the golden period of learning. And that's like, right, that's the best time to learn linguistic skills and music and arts. Like, that's the time of when kids really can soak up and just preserve those knowledge and experiences later on. And then later on, I really believe, I mean, it goes back into my work, but I really believe that's the earlier the better. That's, I guess it's the phrase that most people say, the earlier the better
right.
for most people to learn. So I think that's amazing that you had that opportunity and those chances to learn Japanese in kindergarten.
Yeah, that's why I started learning Japanese in elementary school. I remember there was this program that they had in I don't know if it was all around the country. It was, they call it the Gifted and Talented program.
I was in it, man.
You were in
tag,
it? Oh, cool.
Tag music.
Nice. Yeah, yeah. And so at a certain point, we're taking out of like regular classes to learn other things. So one of the things I learned, I think it might have been the 5th or 6th grade, was I was with this group, and we were learning just a lot about Japanese culture and a little bit of history, but more like the culture and the art.
Yeah, yeah,
so again,
yeah.
I learned a little bit more, you know, the vocabulary and... even had a really good experience where we went to it was an actual legitimate like tea house in Manhattan. So we took a trip, and you know, it was around the time when the Karate Kid Part 2 was really popular.
Right,
so
right.
you know, the whole thing, you know, the whole part of the ceremony, we have to like turn the teacups like three times. So you know, just the whole the tea ceremony, you know, it went just kind of similar to how you saw it in the movie. So. Yeah, I had that experience. So that kind of, that's where I kind of got more and more interested in coming to Japan. And then when I got the opportunity, I said, of course, I'm going to go to Japan.
Did you go to Japan after university?
Yes. Right. So 3 years after.
Okay. And you went to a very good school, too. I noticed you're a graduate of Brown.
That's right.
Totally off topic.
Right.
Do you listen to podcasts, Walter? Do you listen to any?
From time to time, I do. Not regularly, but I do from time to time.
Heard of a crime podcast called Crime Town?
Crime Town, okay.
You might like it. It is. I just finished the entire season one.
Okay.
Season one is about Providence, Rhode Island.
Is it about Providence? Oh, wow.
You know a certain mayor, Buddy
Cianci? Yeah. So, and I know, so everybody...
Write it down.
Yeah.
It is awesome. It is an awesome podcast.
Yeah, Buddy Cianci, he is a legend. It,
yeah. I don't know
his story, like he got elected as mayor while incarcerated, and I know kind of something that happened while he was in. I don't even want to mention it on this podcast, but
in Providence, he's the longest ever held the office of mayor in Providence. He's considered the longest. Mayor. Yeah.
And he also had his own marinara sauce that was on sale in Providence.
Check it out.
I've seen him in person too. And actually, I think he had a house on College Hill. College Hill is an area where Brown was located. But
What did you study in Brown?
Psychology. Yeah.
Not Japanese.
I did not study Japanese.
Okay, well, why not?
I don't know. I didn't study any language. At Brown, the language study was very, very involved. You had the regular class, but then you had lab, which I guess you got into like deeper study or whatever. And Brown is open curriculum, and so you start taking a lot of different classes that you have an interest in. So I guess I just didn't have the space. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I still totally sidetracked it, but I recommend Crime Town.
Okay, Crime Town.
Just totally shameless plug for the podcast. I just finished it. It was an amazing podcast.
Yeah.
It's an amazing series. I think you would be.
All right, I'll be sure to check it out.
Yeah. Anyway, so we come after Brown. Another main reason I wanted to bring you as a guest is like, you were the first person I know when I first came to Japan I came to Japan in 2006.
Okay.
You were one of the first few people I met that actually worked in a Japanese company.
Okay, because I taught English for 3 years.
Right.
And in 2006, in the fall, I think, I changed jobs. I was working for a small company that was providing IT consulting to small and medium-sized businesses.
I think that's when I met you, because I, you know, when I first came in, all I knew were English teachers. So,
right.
So then when I first met you, I met you through, I believe it was Akil. And Akil
yes.
told to met through, you know, mutual friends. I remember, like, wow, I was kind of fascinated when I first met you. How did you do it? How did you get into the Japanese corporate world? And I don't believe I've ever asked you this question.
Well, that segue was easy. So the first company I worked for was, it was actually, so technically it was a Japanese company because it was a, but it was a company that a couple of guys from New Zealand started in Japan. And they had no other offices outside of Japan. So technically, from that standpoint, it's a Japanese company.
Okay.
But a lot of our clients were either Japanese companies or kind of foreign-based companies in Japan. But the even those companies, their presence in Japan has always been very domestic. Environment is very Japanese. So when I first came to Japan, I got myself into a Japanese language school. And so... studied for a few years, and then once I started working in IT in 2006 and dealing with Japanese clients, and in Japanese business level conversation became required immediately.
Was IT always something that you were interested in?
I had a little bit of experience in IT, but the IT that I started out in Japan was more of the infrastructure side. When I was still in the U.S., I worked for my best friend's startup, where I was an account executive for a software solution.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, that was my kind of start in IT.
Wow, okay. So, okay, so from that, you moved after that company. How long were you there for?
I was there for a couple of years, and then we merged with another company that had the same business, you know, providing IT, consulting and project management and engineering services to small, medium-sized businesses. And so that continued on. And then I left that company that we merged with. And then that's when the first time I worked in a really just...
This is what I wanted to know.
Right. So...
This is what I really wanted to know.
I entered a world and never thought I would enter where I'm the only one that's not coming in with the white shirt and dark pants every day.
Yeah.
Just a sea of Japanese people. And me. And, you know, for anyone listening, you can't see how that... just imagine if you're not Japanese and you enter that situation, just how... just kind of, wow, how did I get here?
I mean, let's be honest. Like,
being,
you know, as a black American in the Japanese corporate world, that is so... That's tough, I think. That's just hard to see and hard to... Well, these days now, I think... more and more foreigners are in Japanese companies now, but I believe before the age of smartphones and that time and social media, it was hard for, I think, most foreigners to try to integrate more into the corporate culture, into the Japanese culture, in my opinion. But
I can't speak from before, because I haven't really talked much about, I think... When the economy is doing very well, in a certain way, things are easier for foreigners to be involved and kind of included in the day-to-day, business of a Japanese company. But when the economy is not doing so well, that's when you start feeling that you're becoming like a rarity in corporate Japan.
What was your first day like?
It went very, very, very well. I entered a situation where they really, really needed me. So it was a software development project. They were using a company in France to deploy a software to help with a managed service that was being rolled out here in Japan, but also various regions in the world. They needed me because they couldn't communicate. And so I served the role as what they call a bridge PM, a bridge project manager.
Okay, yeah. I've heard that.
And so that was interesting. It's like during the day, I'm speaking mostly Japanese, even to the French guy that was working on the project, was actually a major stakeholder. But then during the evenings, you know, we'd be on conference calls with the French company and communicating in English.
Okay.
and just making sure that, you know, I hate to use the phrase lost in translation, but to make sure just everybody has the same understanding. But if there are any concerns, those concerns are brought to the table because,
Have you ever figured, like, from the French side, the concerns were quite different from the Japanese side? Was it ever that type of situation that ever occurred for you?
In that project, not really. Okay. It was a long time ago that job experience. But one of the things that I've started to really learn is that in a group in Japan, especially if you are one of the few or only women on the team, you know, people aren't always forthcoming with what they're concerned about or what they're worried about. And I sort of had to get to know what makes people tick, and, you know, just kind of like visual indicators to let me know somebody is worried about something and be able to drag that out of them so that, you know, I can bring that on the table and resolve the kind of mitigate the risk before it becomes an issue.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So moving on, you just continued as a project manager as you continued your career.
Yes.
So was it always similar projects, or were there any projects that were quite challenging as you continued?
So when I worked for my first small IT consulting company, we were mainly doing office moves and new office builds.
Okay.
So those kind of get repetitive, you know, similar issues, similar challenges. But as I progressed in my career, technology started changing.
Yes.
I started working more with the software development teams to try to deliver a new product or service. Also, cloud services started becoming more popular. So in that respect, the kind of project I would handle would change.
Wow, okay. So I want to now, so going to the back to the being as a bridge project manager.
Yes.
What were some things that were, I guess, difficult to handle inside the Japanese company for you specifically? Anything you had trouble with work, or any small anecdotes?
Okay, so I'll talk about one thing that was kind of annoying. But it just something I had to deal with and something that made it better. So our client was in the telecom industry, and just in Japanese business culture, when you're the customer, you know, the customer is God, is what people always say, right? And so, but the other thing is, like, they don't sometimes have the, so in project management, you have what you're supposed to do in a given time. And, you know, you have scope management. And if you want to add to the scope, you have to increase the time or the price, that kind of thing. Well, basically our customer, the person that was representing our customer, he didn't want to face reality. You know, he wanted everything to be delivered within a certain amount of time. My department head would always have this conversation with him and say, I told you from the start, that's not realistic. It's like, yeah. So in other words, you can have X, Y, and Z, but you can't have A, B, and C, or you have to figure out what you want to remove to make it on time. It's like, no, I want everything. So it happened every single week. And sometimes he would get a little bit irritated with me when I kind of just come with him, like, just sharing an issue. He's like, no, I want you to solve that, and just that's it. I'm like, I'm trying to provide just visibility, but okay, fine. You want to have that attitude.
Right.
It's quite all right. What made things better working in that job, in that job situation, is that the team and the department head that I had to work with, we all worked very well together. Day in and day out, we worked in the same project room, and that could be good or bad. Like,
okay.
You know, just sharing the same space with a group of people every single work day. We got along very well.
Okay.
We joked around while doing work. We got work done. It was tough. We worked long hours. We went out to dinner afterwards.
That's good,
and
yeah.
It was just such a good dynamic.
Did you ever feel, because I've always heard these stories where sometimes people who work in Japanese companies, you know, they have less of a private life. They end up using a lot of their time on their weekends to go play golf with their boss or do some type of company activity or event as opposed to having spending time with your family.
Yeah.
Did you ever experience that?
That didn't really apply to me. Okay. So again, they needed me.
Yeah.
And so I had to put my foot down and I let them know that, you know, on Wednesdays.
Yeah.
On Wednesdays, I leave work and I practice kung fu.
There you go.
And I need that in my life. So, and they said, sure. And so they knew.
That's amazing.
On Wednesday, I'm going to get up and leave the office on time.
Okay.
And that's going to help keep me sane. And they want that.
I think you got something going on, Walter. I know some foreigners that work in companies now, they're so hesitant to do that, you know, ask that request or permission from their bosses, like, hey, I have this on my, you know, schedule, I want to leave work by this time. I think it's hard for some foreigners to do.
You know, I think when you progress in your career here in Japan, there's a couple of roads that you can take. One road is you can try to immerse yourself so much into the business culture that you kind of lose a little bit of what the original culture or the original stuff that you came with.
Right.
And I've seen some people go down that path, and it's not always good. And you start to adopt some of the habits that maybe you shouldn't take on. So I'm not saying that there's any one business culture that's perfect.
Yep.
But I like to kind of sit in the middle and take the best of the Japanese business world and the culture of American businesses or Western businesses, because I think there's good ideals from both.
How about for you? You're not the first person that said that to me. Just talking with other foreigners at work.
Yes.
Something that you have to control or manage. Some part of your soul of where you come from.
Yes.
And then how it plays in Japanese business. How do you feel? Do you feel like that give and take was it hard for you to adjust? Because I think some people really, I really believe some people have a hard time, you know, giving the process of giving and taking. It can be really difficult for a lot of foreigners living in Japan.
I think for me, it just it was a learning process, but after a while, so one of the things that happens to me is that I enter a kind of situation and people say, oh, wow, your Japanese is really good. And I've been hearing that for 16 years.
Yeah.
And so part of that, I think, is a subconscious effort to kind of draw a little bit of separations, like you're not Japanese, or I think people who have like an Asian face get this a little bit less, especially East Asian.
Well, I feel like I'm a chameleon in Japan, really.
Right.
People really, I don't feel the same, being Filipino-American, I don't feel the same kind of, self-consciousness.
Right.
As maybe you would.
But they might expect you
they expect me to
speak Japanese and understand the customs more than, like, for me, like, they always want to feel like they need to compliment me and so forth. But, like, what's really happening is they're kind of reinforcing the fact that, okay, you aren't one of us. You kind of just have learned these different things. And so once I realized, no matter how much I tried, I wouldn't ever be fully accepted into, you know, Japanese society and the business culture, I realized, okay, well, that's my opportunity to hold on to some of the values that I have and apply them here when I can.
I think that's really important. What are you doing now these days? Is it different?
It's a different level. Before, I was more just like a sole contributor, just... Mm. I will have projects that I manage and I deliver them and take on new projects and so forth. Now I work for a French company.
Okay.
And I work with a team of engineers and I do sort of their capacity management.
Okay.
And I still take on projects on my own and manage them from beginning to end. But also look at entire portfolio for an infrastructure team. what I like most about my job is the opportunities to develop people.
That's awesome.
And the opportunities to help people work better together. There's politics in every single company, and one of the challenges I've had is like this whole, even within IT, you have one team not wanting to work with another team, and always, you know, the blame game happening when things go wrong, and people say, well, I don't like working with this person, I don't like working with that group. I'm always constantly thrown in a situation where I have to bring people who don't realize that there's an opportunity to do good things or produce good results, right, from working with people, and then getting them to become a little bit more open to working with people with different work styles and getting them to be more effective together.
Okay.
That's something that I like and I take pride in.
You said you studied psychology in university. Do you find that you use some things that you learn with psychology in, as you know, being as a project manager? Do you find yourself?
I do, and you have to. I always say that like probably about 90% of projects fail because the communication had a couple of points of failure. You know, not the technology itself. Yeah, you have great technology, but if people can't communicate effectively and it can't work together, then there's no point. You know, and so I'm always thinking about, you know, just when I talk to people, like, okay, what makes this person tick? What motivates this person? How can I get this person to want to work well with me versus what are the things that will demotivate them? It's like all of those kind of things I'm naturally thinking about when approaching people in different situations.
I'm curious, in your team, how many Japanese people are
on your team now? There are two Japanese people on my team right now, and our boss is Japanese.
Okay. Do you find them, are they very opinionated people? Are they?
My boss tends to have really strong opinions, and he states them very, he easily gives his opinion. He'll call you out when you're trying to bluff him. He'll say, no, that is not a good excuse. Okay. Or that is not an excuse at all. But I think he's rare in that sense, because I think
that's very rare.
I think he had the opportunity to work for like various investment banks,
okay,
and he worked a lot with Westerners, and and so he sort of has that style,
right.
and he does have some very Japanese ways as well.
Right.
So he's is a very good mix of two different worlds, or various worlds.
That's good to know.
Yeah,
because I always wonder, like, because I know teaching in many Japanese companies, there's a lot of passive aggressiveness.
Yeah.
Especially with managers.
Yep.
And they really just don't know how to fully communicate, especially if the team, some team members are younger.
Yes.
And the managers are like, you know, 50 something.
Right.
And then you have like new workers coming in, or like early, late 20s, early 30s.
Yes, yes.
And you can sense the discomfort in the communication.
Absolutely. I mean, even when I was in a steering committee meeting, and we were trying to make a decision on a vendor to select for a project, and it was very clear the vendor to who we should go. It was three vendors. One was just clearly like no go. The second, just looking at the data and just everything about, you know, comparing these two companies, there was clearly one solution. But even then, you know, some of my Japanese colleagues, they couldn't voice their opinion. So for that reason, and I, you know, described, you know, holding on to like your true self earlier, that's when I have to say, okay, I have to state my opinion very clearly and be just succinct and be direct about it. Okay, no mincing words, because other people are not going to do it. And then if everyone communicates in that way, we'll never make a decision.
Walter, what do you think is going to happen in the future? I know everyone has their own opinion about the future of Japanese business and Japanese corporations, but what's your take on it? Like, do you think the Japanese, I'm talking about the traditional Japanese companies now, do you think they can adjust or evolve into something more from what they are now, you know?
I think they're going to have to if they want to survive. So there's a lot of talk right now about diversity and inclusion. Well, I hear a lot of that talk from, you know, just keeping in touch with what's going on with American businesses. And diversity and inclusion, this whole idea has resulted in jobs. You know, people will be the director of diversity and inclusion. And it's sort of something that's coming up in Japan. But right now, so in America, what diversity and inclusion is all about is having minorities and people with disabilities and people with different sexual orientations, giving people a seat at the table and giving them a voice and allowing people to having a diversity amongst the management. Yes. But in Japan right now, it's kind of focused on giving women a voice. So it seems like that's where they're starting. And they need to address that issue because women are underutilized in the workplace right now. So getting back to your question, there's a kind of a new startup movement. And, you know, Japanese people who have studied overseas are starting to see those kind of companies have better opportunities for them because they don't fit into the mold of a traditional Japanese company. With what I've learned and what many companies have learned, there's a lot of value in diversity. When you come into situations when you want to problem solve, you get people to come from different ways of thinking. They're looking at a problem from different angles, and that's very valuable because, you know, you have people who come from only a certain perspective. They may not have the tools or the know-how to solve a certain problem, but, you know, you bring people from different cultures, you know, it's a beautiful thing.
But that's why I always thought studying languages and speaking different languages, that to me is a beautiful thing, is where when you know this, when you speak different languages, there's a different mindset and there's a different way to think about how to explain a problem or how to solve a problem. I believe, you know, not just speaking only English and or speaking Japanese or Spanish as well.
Yeah.
I think learning different languages really expands your mind and thinking about clearly different ways of solving problems, as you said.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And it's definitely mind expansion.
Yeah.
From studying Japanese, I realize there's ways that I can think about a certain idea in Japanese that it wouldn't work so much in English because we don't think of a certain thing we don't like, so one thing can have like five different words in Japanese because it describes a certain level of detail versus in America we don't care about that level of detail. I think they were saying once, I think I read somewhere that in that Eskimos have so many different words for cold. And I guess that makes sense. The one thing I gotta say something positive about Japanese way of doing things. There's a high level of quality assurance.
Yes.
And this is where we get we get some project management principles from Japanese culture. The word Kaizen exists in project management, like as is. Continuous improvement. But what I wish that Japanese people in corporations would do a little bit more of is embrace that aspect of your culture that exists already. The idea of Kaizen, continuous improvement.
Yeah.
So that means you have a process. And, you know, this country is very process oriented. But, you know, process, just like a product, has a life cycle.
Yeah.
It makes sense for a time. But things change, people evolve, technology evolves. You know, the problems that you have one day don't exist in the future. And so your process might be outdated, it might not be effective, and there are things that you might need to change to keep up with the changes in, you know, the environment or technology or what have you.
I agree with you. I think, you know, the whole idea of, you know, the Kaizen mentality came from the automobile industry.
It did.
But this is what I worry about, because that is the most positive thing about the Japanese companies. Like the idea, they're so focused on. What is your advice for incoming foreigners, especially coming from America? Any advice for foreigners that want to live and work in Japan?
Yeah. So But I've noticed that you know, living and working in Japan, it could be a very rewarding experience.
Yeah.
And it could be a lot of fun at times, just learning a new culture, learning a new way of thinking. But it could also be frustrating because, you know, just some of the things that we talked about, you know, the history is different from our history. The way people think is completely different and strongly tied to the culture. But ask more how questions versus why. Stop asking, well, why do you do it this way? Or ask, well, how does that work? Or, you know, ask the more like positive end and make the assumption that it is, you know, a certain way of thinking is a good way of thinking. And, you know, people will share those ideas with you. And you can kind of, if you approach Japan with a more of an open mind versus like, oh, everything is different here and I don't understand why. You know, if you go that route, then you'll frustrate yourself. But if you ask more how questions, I think that will, people will open up more to share with you, and you'll get more of the positives out of living and working here.
The listeners, if you can't even see me, I'm just really like deeply nodding in agreement with this great advice, because I really believe most people don't ask that how question.
Right.
They instinctively start with the why this, why that.
Right.
And then, yeah, Walter, thank you. That is great advice for incoming foreigners, right? But yeah, Walter, thank you so much for that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, man. All right, thanks.
So that was one Walter Edwards. A huge thank you for him to come out and take the time and share his story with me. I think that advice that he gives is a huge advice. Ask the how question, not the why question. You're listening to Made in Japan podcast, Conversations with Meljo Catalan. You can find me on Instagram at Made in Japan podcast or at Facebook, same handle. Also, feel free to, if you have any questions or comments about this episode, or if you really want to ask a question concerning, you know, directly towards Walters, I can definitely share your question to him if you want to email me. Yeah, just my email is japanmademepodcast@gmail.com. And so, yeah, thank you for listening, and I hope this was something worthwhile for you, and I will be back with another guest for another episode. Thanks and peace out. Take care.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.